There's a worldwide struggle going on for the hearts and minds of mankind. For a time, we called it the Cold War, then detente. Actually, the struggle has been going on for a century or more. It's the contest between capitalism and socialism. Those who favor socialism have managed to conjure up an unpleasant image by simply saying the word, capitalism. Yet capitalism is what America's all about. Indeed, you can't have freedom without capitalism. For capitalism simply means your right as an individual to own things, to do what you will with the money you earn, to buy a piece of land, build a home of your own. Today, plagued by the high cost of living, we hear more and more voices raised in criticism of our way of life. They talk of a utopia where there would be no poverty, no unemployment, where an all-wise government would make all the hard decisions for us, and we'd have cradle-to-grave security. Now, the word utopia is from the Greek, and it means nowhere. We should make the disciples of socialism talk about the somewheres of socialism because there are some. Sweden, for example, where the income tax is 30% on incomes of only $6,000, where workers resort to barter to keep from moving into an even higher tax bracket. In Red China, it takes a year's income to buy a wristwatch. Even in those countries which have a mix, some free enterprise and some nationalization of business, the story is the same. Not too long ago, France announced the price for installing a phone was going up from $111 to $244, and even at that price, people have to wait as much as 3 years to get one. John Kenneth Galbraith, the celebrated economist, came to public notice many years ago with his book, The Affluent Society, which made the point that you and I were rolling in luxury while the so-called public sector was starved for funds. His suggestion was that we, the people, were foolishly buying all the wrong things, and that government should take a greater share of our money from us in taxes, and government did, to buy for us the things we really needed and were too stupid to buy. In a more recent book, he says private enterprise has failed and socialism is the only answer. Well, now let's get down to cases. Let's take a good look at a huge nation that's had 50 years to put into practice a completely socialist system. The Soviet Union has more territory than the United States, a larger population, 250 million capable people, and a great many natural resources. Now, you know, we could match their socialist utopia. It'd take a little doing. We'd have to cut our paychecks by 75%, move 60 million workers back to the farm, abandon two-thirds of our steel-making capacity, destroy 40 million TV sets, tear up 14 out of every 15 miles of highway, junk 19 out of 20 autos, tear up two-thirds of our railroad track, knock down 70% of our houses and rip out 9/10 of our telephones. Then all we'd have to do is find a capitalist country that would sell us wheat on credit to keep us from starving. Not too long ago on one of these broadcasts, I quoted an anonymous source to the effect that if all of us knew on a certain day the world was ending, the roads, streets, and telephone lines would be jammed with people trying to reach someone to say, I love you. Since then, some of you have written to express agreement with that unknown author. And some have begun a sentence with the words, if only I had, or hadn't, as the case might be. Back in World War II, a father wrote a letter to his soldier son in the form of a poem. Dear son, I wish I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight as I sit watching that small star and wondering where and how you are. You know, son, it's a funny thing how close a war can really bring a father who for years with pride has kept emotions deep inside. I'm sorry, son. When you were small, I let reserve build up that wall. I told you real men never cried. And it was Mom who always dried your tears and smoothed your hurts away so that you soon went back to play. But son, deep down within my heart, I longed to have some little part in drying that small tear-stained face. But we were men. Men don't embrace. And suddenly I found my son a full-grown man with childhood done. Tonight, you're far across the sea fighting a war for men like me. Well, somehow pride and what is right have changed places here tonight. I find my eyes won't stay quite dry, and that men sometimes really cry. And if we stood here face to face, I'm sure, my son, we would embrace. Son, dads are quite a funny lot, and if I failed you on some spot, it's not because I loved you less, but just this cussed manliness. And if I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight, the words would ring out loud and true. I'm proud, my son. Yes, proud of you. He signed to Dad, walked down to the corner, and dropped it in the mailbox. As he returned home and reached his own doorstep, he was handed a War Department telegram, the kind that began with the fateful words, "We regret to inform you." I'm glad that I can believe his son knows he wrote that letter. This is a legend of success and plunder, and a man, Tom Smith, who squelched world hunger. Now, Smith, an inventor, had specialized in toys, so people were surprised when they found that he, instead of making toys, was baking bread. The way to make bread he'd conceived cost less than people could believe. And not just make it. This device could, in addition, wrap and slice. The price per loaf, one load or many. The minuscule sum of under a penny. Can you imagine what this meant? Can you comprehend the consequent? The first time yet the world well fed, at all because of Tom Smith's bread. A citation from the president for Smith's amazing bread. This and other honors, too, were heaped upon his head. But isn't it a wondrous thing how quickly fame has flown? Smith, the hero of today, tomorrow scarcely known. Yes, the fickle years passed by. Smith was a millionaire, but Smith himself was now forgot, though bread was everywhere. People asked from where it came, would very seldom know. They would simply eat and ask, was it not always so? However, Smith cared not a bit, for millions ate his bread and everything is fine, thought he. I'm rich and they are fed. Everything was fine, he thought. He reckoned not with fate. Note the sequence of events starting on the date on which the business tax went up. Then, to a slight extent, the price on every loaf rose, too, up to 1 full cent. What's going on, the public cried. He's guilty of pure plunder. He has no right to get so rich on other people's hunger. Well, since the public does come first, it would not be denied that in matters such as this, the public must decide. So antitrust now took a hand. Of course, it was appalled at what it found was going on. The bread trust, it was called. Now, this was getting serious, so Smith felt that he must have a friendly interview with the men in antitrust. So hat in hand, he went to them. They'd surely been misled. No rule of law had he defied. But then their lawyer said, "The rule of law in complex times has proved itself deficient. We much prefer the rule of men. It's vastly more efficient." "Now let me state the present rules," the lawyer then went on. "These very simple guidelines you can rely upon. You're gouging on your prices if you charge more than the rest, but it's unfair competition if you think you can charge less. A second point that we would make to help avoid confusion, don't try to charge the same amount. That would be collusion. You must compete, but not too much, for if you do, you see, then the market would be yours, and that's monopoly. Price too high or price too low? Now which charge did they make?" Well, they weren't loath to charging both, with public good at stake. In fact, they went one better. They charged monopoly. No muss, no fuss. Oh, woe is us, egad, they charged all three. 5 years in jail, the judge then said. You're lucky it's not worse. Robber barons must be taught society comes first. Now bread is baked by government, and as might be expected, everything is well controlled, the public well protected. True, loaves cost $1 each, but our leaders do their best. The selling price is 0.5 cent. Taxes pay the rest. My award for someone who thought of the right answer while the discussion was still going on is a young man named Brad Linneweaver, a member of Young Americans for Freedom at Pennsylvania State University. He has written of an encounter on the campus with a pretty young lady who believes socialism is the answer to our problems. His own philosophy was self-evident because he was wearing a button that proclaimed, "Cut down big government." With the cool breeze stirring her hair, she asked what Brad described as her ace-up-the-sleeve question. "Even you right-wingers don't want to starve. Wouldn't you like a guarantee that you won't ever go hungry?" Brad knew that if he admitted this, she'd follow with, "So why not such a guarantee for shelter, medicine, and all the rest?" He paused and then gave her the victory she was seeking, or so she thought. He said, "Sure, I'd like to lay my hands on everything I can get." "Oh," she said, "but the state is the closest you can come to such a guarantee." Brad described her as braced for a counterattack involving the magic of the market mechanism. But he threw another curve. "Sure," he said, "I grant that. There's something more. I'd like a guarantee of shelter and medical treatment and even some recreation." She must have thought she had a convert. A little shocked, she spoke, "But that's what we support. Why are you wearing that button?" She meant, of course, that cut down big government button. Brad wasn't finished. He said to her, "I would also like a yacht." Somewhat defeated, she answered, "Well, if you're not going to be serious about it." "Oh, but I am," Brad said as earnestly as he could. "I would really and truly like a yacht. Also, a seaside villa." "Look," she said sternly, "you know what I'm talking about. Sharing. I'm not interested in your greedy daydreams. I'm asking what everyone should have." "All right," Brad answered, "I understand. Let everyone have a yacht." "But how?" she asked lucidly, with the first sign of a rational thought. "Don't bother me with that," he said. "There'll be a way, I'm sure, just so everyone has a yacht. However, there is one more thing I would like." "What?" she asked. "Two yachts." Brad wrote that she looked rather unpleasant at that point, and he feared for his safety. Then she declared, "It's people like you who keep socialism from working." Brad agreed. "Yes, quite right. Perhaps if people like me were put away somewhere, socialism would have a chance." By now she was really glaring as she tried to think of an answer. Brad continued, "But there's still one problem. How many are there like me?" "Well, not as many as you think," she said, and walked away. And then Brad came up with a really appropriate last line. He wrote, "There she's wrong, and that's why she's a socialist." How right he is. Socialists ignore the side of man that is of the spirit. They can provide shelter, fill your belly with bacon and beans, treat you when you're ill, all the things that are guaranteed to a prisoner or a slave. They don't understand that we also dream. Yes, even of sometime owning a yacht. The names of some presidents are invoked by spokesmen of both political parties as men for all seasons, epitomizing the greatness of America. Names such as Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson. Then there are presidents whose names are brought up in party circles, hailed as great, but if acknowledged by the other party at all, with not quite the same enthusiasm. There are also two lists of presidential names, one for each party, usually held up to view for strictly partisan purposes. Each party lists past presidents of the opposing party as examples of that party's terrible record. The Democrats, for example, get laughs by mentioning Silent Cal Coolidge. And truth is, many Republicans chuckle a little and go along with the idea that he was a do-nothing president. Sometimes I wonder if he really was a do-nothing, or was he a little like a lifeguard on the beach, who also seems to be doing very little when there's no emergency. But if you take a closer look, he's quietly being watchful. Cal Coolidge is good for laughs, but not all of them are at his expense. There was the press conference where a persistent reporter asked the president if he had anything to say about prohibition. Cal said, "No." "Any comments on the world court?" "No." "What about the farm situation?" Again, the answer was no. The reporter said, "You don't seem to have any comment about anything." Coolidge said, "No comment, and don't quote me." Shortly after he became president, he sent his teenage son into the tobacco fields to work in the summer as he always had. One of the other workers, surprised at this, said to the young Coolidge, "If my father were president, I wouldn't be out here working in the field." Young Coolidge said, "If my father were your father, you would." But while Cal seemed to be doing nothing as president, the federal budget actually went down, and so did the national debt. Consumer prices fell, but unemployment stayed at the we only dream of 3.5%, which means that everyone who wanted a job had one. Federal taxes were cut 4 times. The number of automobiles on our streets and highways tripled during his years in the White House, and radio sales went up 1,400%. In just the 5 years from 1922 to 1927, the purchasing power of wages rose 10%. It was a kind of golden era in other ways. Hollywood would never again be more glamorous, and there were giants in the sports arenas whose names are still legend. The Manassas Mauler, Jack Dempsey, Canute Rockne, the Four Horsemen, Red Grange, Babe Ruth, and Big Bill Tilden. Now, I'm not saying that President Coolidge was responsible for them, but they were larger-than-life figures that went with America's place in the world. So, what if he was a do-nothing president? Do you suppose that doing nothing had something to do with reducing the budget, reducing the debt, and cutting taxes 4 times?